From Spark and Anvil and Gambit Tales, this is Lady Skewer in Chapter 1 of the Gambit Tales cast. This drama uses an AI-generated voice, voiced via Gemini 2.5. The southwest wall of the Academy Library has a long oak table that nobody else uses, because nobody else needs a long oak table to teach chess. Lady Skewer needs one. She has laid out along its polished surface this morning an entire roast skewer set, 5 thin metal pins of graduated length, polished to a slightly defensive mirror, arranged in a precise row like the keys of a small silver flute. Beside the pins, on a small wooden board, she has placed 3 pieces from a chess set, a rook, a queen, and a king. The king is in the front. The queen is sitting 3 squares behind, watching. A small student, 11 years old, leans on the edge of the table to get a better look. He has a green scarf and a small ink blot on one cuff that he has not yet noticed. He says, "Lady Skewer, what are the cooking skewers for?" Lady Skewer picks up the longest pin. She holds it lightly, not like a weapon, but more like a tool whose properties she has always understood at the level of muscle memory. She lays the pin flat on the board so that one end touches the king and the other end touches the queen. The pin's silver length bridges the 2 pieces in a single visible line. "This," she says, "is the line." She bows slightly when she says it. She bows slightly when she says most things, which the children at the academy have come to find oddly reassuring. She is in her late 20s, and she looks a little like a duchess on holiday. A clean linen tunic, polished boots in unimpeachable condition, dark hair pinned at the back of her neck with a thin silver clasp. Other teachers at the academy have tried, occasionally over the years, to seem more relaxed in front of the children. Lady Skewer has never seen the point of the exercise. "The king is in the front," she continues, in her measured way. "The queen is behind. They are joined by the line. If I attack the king," and she taps the pin's tip gently against the wooden base of the king has to move. That is simply what kings do when they are attacked. They get out of the way of the thing pointing at them. The boy nods, slowly, following the geometry. "And when the king has moved," she says, "what do you suppose happens to the queen?" The boy considers the board for a long moment. He says, finally, "She's just sitting there." "Yes," says Lady Skewer, with quiet approval. "She is sitting there, with nothing in front of her, with my pin still pointing at her along the same line that ran through the king." She smiles, politely, courteously, and waits for the boy to catch up to the full implication of the geometry she has just laid out for him.
She was not born knowing the line. She was born into a family that made cooking skewers, which is a different thing in most respects, though it turned out, much later, to be the same thing in the one respect that mattered. Skewer House, her grandfather's name for the family workshop, sits in the foothills of the Eastern Range, about 3 days' walk from the Slow Lake. The Slow Lake, as it happens, is also the village Sir Pinwell came from, though neither of them knew this until they were both grown and had begun comparing childhood landscapes over evening tea at the academy. Adela Marrowstone of Skewer House grew up watching her grandfather hammer skewers, her father hammer skewers, her mother run the family books with quiet exactness, and her aunt managed the shipping crew with rather less quiet exactness. She was, until the age of 11, a perfectly normal Marrowstone child. Competent, polite, slightly bored by the rhythm of small-town craft. Then, at 11, she became interested. She used the word interested the way other children would use the word amazing. It was the strongest word she allowed herself, and she rationed it carefully. What she had become interested in was the line. She had watched 10,000 skewers being made over the course of her childhood, and she had noticed something the rest of her family had long ago stopped noticing. A skewer, considered as a tool, has a peculiar property. The front of it pierces, the back of it supports. The line between is what makes the whole thing work as a single object. If the back of the skewer is heavy, the front of the skewer has to go where the back sends it. Adela began to look for the line in other places. She watched her aunt's shipping crew loading barrels onto a cart. A heavy barrel placed behind a light one pushed the light one forward, whether the light one liked it or not. She watched her mother sort the family accounts in the evening. A number written in one column changed a number written 3 lines down in another. She watched her father's apprentice carry a long wooden board through a narrow doorway, the back of the board, swinging slowly, decided where the front of the board had to point. She wrote at 12 a notebook entry that her family still keeps on a shelf at Skewer House. The piece behind decides what the piece in front has to do. If the piece behind is heavier, the piece in front has to move. The piece in front does not get to choose. Her family thought this entry was charming. They did not realize they were watching in real time the early career of one of the kingdom's premier chess tacticians. She was 16 the first time she saw an actual chess game in progress. Two old men at a fair, playing on a board outside a bakery, with a small crowd of older onlookers murmuring around them. She watched for nearly an hour and understood most of what was happening, not at all. She understood the bishop instantly. The bishop moved along a line. That was all she needed to know about the bishop, and the rest could come later. When the bishop attacked the rook, and the rook had to move out of its way, and the queen was sitting three squares behind on the same diagonal, she saw what was about to happen several beats before either of the players did. She walked back to Skewer House. The walk took her 10 days through autumn weather. She told her grandfather, who was that day hammering skewer number 974,000, that she was leaving in the morning to become a chess player. Her grandfather considered this announcement. He set down the hammer carefully on his workbench. He said, "Adela, have you ever played chess?" "No," she said, "but I understand the line. It is the same line." He looked at her for a long, slow moment. Then he reached for the longest skewer on his workbench, a polished outdoor roasting pin, the kind they sold for cooking lamb at festivals, and put it gently into her hand. "Take this," he said. "If anyone ever asks you what you are doing, hold this up. People will understand." She took it.
She walked to the capital across the autumn countryside. It took her 10 days. Her boots were new at the start of the journey and not at the end of it. The academy gates were taller than she had imagined, and the courtyard inside was smaller. There was nobody on hand to receive her. The academy did not formally admit students. You simply turned up at the door, and someone, eventually, agreed to sit down and play with you. A clerk at a high wooden desk asked her name without looking up. "Lady Skewer," she said. She had decided this on the walk. Adela Marrowstone of Skewer House was too long for a name. Adela by itself sounded like somebody's daughter, which she was, but which she had not come here to be. Lady Skewer told the truth about what she had come to do, which seemed the only useful thing a name could be expected to do. The clerk wrote it down without comment. He still did not look up. She unfastened her satchel. She drew out her grandfather's cooking skewer and held it up, silver, thin, a little over a foot long, polished to a mirror at the tip. The clerk looked up. He laughed once, briefly. Adela did not. After a moment, the clerk stopped laughing. He found her a board and an opponent, and she played three games against the same patient junior master. She lost the first one because she did not yet know the proper names of the pieces. She drew the second one because she had figured most of them out by the end. She won the third one decisively, with a bishop and a rook, by attacking a queen and capturing the king behind it on a diagonal, so clean that her opponent set his pieces back up, looked at her across the board, and said, "Do that again, please." The academy master had wandered over during the third game. He watched the final 10 moves from over her shoulder with the unhurried attention of a man who has seen many opening encounters. When the game ended, he stood quietly for a long moment, his hands clasped politely behind his back. Then he said, to nobody in particular, "Oh, good, another one." He had been doing his job for 27 years by then. He had seen many of these. He still smiled when he saw one. Adela bowed slightly. She put the cooking skewer back into her satchel, specifically into the velvet pouch her aunt had stitched for her on the night before she left, which she had not, until that moment, used for anything at all. She has used it every day since. She has been Lady Skewer ever since.
This morning, in the academy library, with the cooking skewers laid out and the boy in the green scarf still looking at her, she does what she always does when she teaches the skewer pattern for the very first time. She moves the king piece off its square, slowly, so the boy can see exactly what happens at each step of the motion. She lifts the pin clear of the king. She lays the pin's tip against the queen. "The line," she says, "did not move. I did not move. The king moved. And now the queen is sitting at the end of the line, where the king used to be in front of her. The boy looks at the queen. "Take it," Lady Skewer says, politely. The boy reaches over and picks up the queen with careful fingers. He sets it aside on a square of empty wood. "That," Lady Skewer says, "is the skewer." By this point in the lesson, four other students have drifted over to the long oak table, attracted by the cooking skewers, which are not what children expect to see in a chess library. Sir Pinwell is there too, leaning against the door frame at the far end of the room, watching with his arms folded across his chest. He has been watching her for a while. He does not interrupt her lesson. He never does. Lady Skewer continues, as if she has been addressing the whole room from the start. "You will see this pattern again. You will see it on diagonals. You will see it on ranks. You will see it on files. You will see it with bishops, with rooks, with queens. You may sometimes see it with a king in front of the line. And when you see that, remember, the king must move. There is no choice. That is the absolute version of the pattern." She places the king back on the board. She lays the pin against the king once more, returning the demonstration to its starting position. "The piece in front," she says, "does not get to choose. That is the whole craft." A girl, 8 years old, with a fork-shaped pin in her hair, asks the question that always arrives at this point. "Lady Skewer, but what if the front piece is small? What if it isn't the king or the queen? What if it's a pawn?" Lady Skewer considers this question. She likes it. She looks at the longest cooking skewer on the table for a moment, drawing the analogy together in her mind before speaking. "You would not skewer a single mushroom alone," she says. "You need something worth moving. If the front piece is small, the line still exists, but nobody minds losing the front piece, so the line does no work. You skewer when the front is valuable. That is the rule of the kitchen, and it is also the rule of the board." The girl writes this down in a small notebook. The notebooks at this academy are spreading, Lady Skewer thinks, the way ivy spreads on a stone wall, slowly at first, then all at once, and never quite reversibly.
After the children file out for lunch, Lady Skewer remains at the long oak table, packing the cooking skewers back into their flat leather case in their precise order of length. Sir Pinwell pushes off the doorframe and crosses the library to her. He stops at the table. He looks at the chessboard, which still has the rook and the queen on it, and at the empty square where the king used to stand. He says, "Clean." "Thank you," she says. He nods. After a moment, he says, "The lantern was watching, from the gallery." Lady Skewer looks up at the gallery, a small wooden balcony along the south wall of the library, where the older students sometimes sit and read. It is empty now, but it would not have been empty during the lesson if Pinwell had taken the trouble to notice. "What did she think?" Lady Skewer says. "You will have to ask her yourself." "I will." She buckles the leather case shut. She slides the case carefully into her satchel. Her grandfather's cooking skewer, the one she has carried since she was 16, lives in a separate velvet pouch tied to her belt. She pats it gently with the fingers of one hand, the way some people pat a dog they have known for a very long time. She says, half to Pinwell and half to nobody in particular. She thinks the simultaneous is more elegant than the sequential. "I know," says Pinwell. "I have told her," says Lady Skewer, "that she is wrong." "I know," says Pinwell. "But politely." "Always politely," says Pinwell. They walk together out of the library in the direction of the dining hall. At the door, Sir Pinwell asks her, because he has not yet had the chance to ask her this morning, what she will be teaching this afternoon. Lady Skewer thinks about it for a moment. Then she smiles, the small, pleased smile of somebody placing a finished thing on a shelf where it belongs. "I move the front piece," she says. "Then I take the back one." "Yes," says Pinwell. They go into lunch together.
You've been listening to a Spark and Anvil chapter, written by the Spark and Anvil writing team for ages 9 to 14. Spark and Anvil is a 501c3 public charity. Apps stay free forever. Curriculum aligned to Lady Skewer. Released under Creative Commons BYNCSA 4.0 for educational reuse. Visit Spark and Anvil for the full transcript.